Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. There would be no life without constant death. It's the opening line from Jack Lohman's new book, White Light, the elemental role of phosphorus in our cells, in our food, and in our world. Phosphorus is the rarest of the six elements biology needs for life to occur. It's one of the main ingredients found in fertilizer. White light is a reflection on the cyclical nature of life, what happens when we break that cycle and how to repair it. It's told through the fate of phosphorus in our bedrock, in our fertilizers, our food, and in our cells. And in the book, Jack Lohman travels to the phosphate mines of England, Florida, Morocco, and Nauru to uncover the scientific, geopolitical, cultural, and health consequences of the past 150 years of strip mining phosphorus. Jack Lohman is a writer from Richmond, Virginia. White Light is his first book. He lives in the Western Isles of Scotland. Jack Lohman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I want to talk about your adventurous life first, just very briefly. I understand you've lived not only in Scotland, but Mongolia. So start with Mongolia. What's that like?
That's right. Well, for the last 2.5 years, until about the middle of last year, I lived in the little town of Arba here, which is a medium-sized town right on the edge of the Gobi Desert and right in the center of Mongolia, geographically speaking. It's a beautiful little town. It's fairly nondescript. It's the kind of place where so much has happened over time and it's mellowed out into a place that a lot of people tend to ignore. It's a really wonderful spot to be.
Now, the Western Isles of Scotland, I think what you're trying to go for rural places?
That's exactly right. I've always wanted to live in a rural place. I've always wanted to be connected to the ground, to grow vegetables, to be surrounded by as much natural beauty as possible. It's been a part of my life from the very beginning. I'm living now on the island of Benbecula, the Isle of Benbecula and the Western Isles. It's part of the Outer Hebrides of Scotland.
Yeah, sounds beautiful. Sounds remote as well. I guess that's an attraction for you.
It is, yes. Yeah. I find that the further away I go, the stronger is the feeling of community and connection to people around me.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's it makes sense, yeah. Phosphorus, you might think a whole book on phosphorus. In fact, you got a nice blurb from Pico Iyer. He said, I had no interest in phosphorus until I picked up this book. Now, I find it's connected to everything, right? I guess you've gardened probably, obviously. So phosphate, we use that fertilizer. Farmers do around the world. We'll get into talking about that. But how did the book start?
I've always been terrified of death. And as you say, I've always loved to garden. To me, this is a book about what it means to be alive and also about what it means to die. I didn't think I was writing a book about those subjects when I started working on this. I thought that I was writing a fairly straightforward article about one place, about the island of Nauru, which is this small island country located far out in the Pacific Ocean that was nearly entirely strip mined for phosphate during the 20th century. More than 80% of the land area of the island was destroyed. When I started working on that project, what fascinated me was that this place provided a perfect encapsulation of what will happen when people talk about an apocalyptic future, when people talk about concerns about devastation, in this case related to mining, and then what happens when that bears out, because on this island, the mining ended after about 100 years, and I wanted to write about what would happen in the aftermath. In the aftermath, there were all kinds of human rights abuses. We might get more into this later. There was a real decline in terms of the culture, the economic, political, social culture of the country. And as a part of that decline, journalists were blocked from visiting for many years. I was a student when I began working on this project, and I thought that I might be able to slip into the country without being fingered as a prominent journalist or somebody associated with the news network, I might be able to write about what was going on at the very, very beginning of my career. That's what I did. In the process of writing about it, I found that there was so much to say. There were so many connections to parts of the world I had previously learned about. I wanted to explain what phosphorus was. If I talked about the mining that was going on there, I needed to talk about what was mined and why it was mined. And then I wanted to talk about the complication of that mining, reasons in which it may have been, in surprising ways, not done with the results we would have thought it would have had. There were all kinds of vectors and directions the story took. That's how this became a book. It began as a very tight little story here, and it ended up as something that feels to me, at least, much more sprawling.
Yeah, it is fascinating. We'll loop back to Nauru, but just one more thing on Nauru before we jump into. I want to ask you what phosphorus actually is and why it's so important. I happened to a couple of years ago pull up a little documentary on Nauru. This journalist had, I guess, gained access as well that tightly controlled, right? Because the government's essentially, I think, ashamed of what's happened there. What was it like? It used to be a garden spot, right? It used to be lush vegetation. All that strip mining has left it what? Tell me a little bit about what Nauru was like when you were there.
Well, this was an island that has been inhabited for thousands of years. The extent of time is a little bit unclear. It was self-sufficient during this time. It's far enough away from any other landmass or even any other inhabited island that people needed to get what they got from that place. There were trees across it, there were fields, there were farms in which plants were grown. People raised fish in the internal lagoon of the island, Wada Lagoon. It was a place that was relatively lush. It provided fresh water. Now, the fresh water is gone. The water has to be provided by desalination plants because what was there isn't there anymore. The formation of phosphate rock anywhere in the world happens because of concentrations of life. Life concentrates over thousands or millions of years. It's fossilized, it's preserved, it breaks down due to external forces that hold it in place. Some of the same forces that preserve fossils, which, by the way, tend to be rich in phosphate as well. In Nauru, the concentration of life came from a coral reef that had existed on the top of this former undersea volcano for a long time. And probably it also came from guano, bird poop. A mixture of the two, fossilized, preserved over time, turned into rock phosphate, and then eventually uplifted out of the water by geological forces long before humans ever came to the place. The result is that the structure of the island looked like a sea of limestone columns. These were the remnants of the coral reef, long, long since disappeared. But it looked like these 40, 50, 80-foot tall pillars of rock surrounded by phosphate, packed by phosphate, covered by phosphate, and covered above that by layers of trees and vegetation and human life. These pinnacles were, for the most part, hidden. Some of them might have stuck out above the level of the earth, but they were buried. When the miners came, they first removed the upper layer of the earth. Then they dug up the phosphate around the pinnacles. When the mining finished, it ran out really in the 1990s, although there's still little bits and pieces of mining happening now. What was left were fields and fields of pinnacles. If you mined an area and left flat land, you might be able to use that land. But if you mine a place and leave behind thousands of enormous towering pinnacles, you can't then go into that land and use it. It's too expensive. And so 80% of the land area of Nauru was lost.
And for the people there, right? High rates of unemployment, diabetes, obesity, alcoholism. It's a lot of problems.
That's right. During the time of the mining, Nauru became the second richest country by measure of per capita GDP in the world. Its entire economy, like its land, was overtaken by mining. When the mining ran out, the economy crashed. Nothing was there. There was a vacuum in its place. And in its place, the government tried all kinds of different measures to return to some kind of prosperity, selling bank licenses, selling passports. Billions of dollars have been laundered through Nauru as a result of this. And about 24 years ago, the government of Australia came to Nauru with an offer to pay really high amounts of money in order to hold asylum seekers there against their will. These were people from around the world who tried to claim asylum in Australia. And instead of being kept in Australia, they were shipped to Nauru and held for years and years and years, 8, 9 years. People were held in camps that were situated within the former mines. Some of these pinnacles were ground up and moved. The detention facilities were placed there. And that, since then, has come to dominate the economy of the island. It's a strange situation in which the industry, this particular industry, this refugee processing industry, in which the government is being paid at various points in time up to a couple of $1 million per year per person held in the camp. The government is being paid, and this provides the vast majority, not only of the government's revenue, but of the country's GDP. This has become a country that exists almost entirely on the basis of human suffering.
Well, let's back up. In your prologue, you have a wonderful illustration of this, of that sentence from your book, "There would be no life without constant death." So the prologue is the death of a whale and what happens. So tell us a bit about that.
There is a wonderful illustration there, and I was so lucky to work with such a talented illustrator who made this really a beautiful book throughout. Every chapter has a plate with these beautiful lino cut illustrations that are block printed onto the pages. This one in particular shows what happens when a whale dies. When a whale passes away, it begins to sink. Takes a bit of time, the air has to exit its body. As it sinks, it descends into darkness, the darkness of the deep sea. When it settles on the bottom of the sea, it's sitting in total dark. And note, if there's no light, there are no plants, there's no vegetation here. There's very little available nutrition to any being that would come. And then suddenly there is this enormous deceased creature lying right there. Organisms begin to come from across the ocean floor, the sea floor, wherever the whale has fallen to. They begin to eat the blubber of the whale. They eat the organs, the parts. Eventually, bones are left. This often takes a couple of years for this point to be reached. When the bones are left, organisms feast on those bones for decades. And what you have in the end is a multi-decade ecosystem that exists in thousands of places all across the ocean that relies entirely on the death of a whale. There are even certain species that have evolved to eat only these dead whales. It's a particular ecosystem that relies entirely on death. And this is what this book is about. This is a book about feasting on death, about the cycles of life and death. They connect us to the ground. Recently, with the advent of mining and a lot of changes in our creation and production of phosphate fertilizers, we've broken those cycles. We've disconnected from them. But at the end of the day, whatever it is we're doing, we're relying on the bodies of our ancestors in order to live.
So what is phosphorus? We know that it glows, right? It's one of those elements. Phosphorus is in matches, creates fire. But one thing I learned from your book is that phosphorus is necessary for life.
That's right. Phosphorus is a chemical element, the symbol P on the periodic table. When it exists on its own, this is as just P. It burns, as you say. It burns on contact to air. If exposed to oxygen, it will catch fire. This is why matches have phosphorus. There's a paper coating over a thin layer of phosphorus. When you strike the match, you break the paper, and the phosphorus is exposed to the air. It burns. Bombs, certain munitions in war, are made of phosphorus. When fired into the air, they burn through the skin, and they won't be stopped by water. They will only be stopped by sand or by time. Phosphate is what we use in fertilizer. Phosphate is what makes our body. Phosphate is a compound of phosphorus and oxygen. And so, in fact, if you burn phosphorus, you are combining the phosphorus that's pure with oxygen in the air, what you end up with is phosphate. Phosphate is stable. It does not burn. Its primary ingredient is phosphorus, but it has a whole other set of uses that are absolutely necessary for life. Phosphate forms the structure of our DNA. It forms the structure of our cells. The membrane of the cells is made of phospholipids. These are phosphates combined with fats, with lipids. Phosphate is a part of ATP, adenosine triphosphate, which is what powers all of our bodies. This is how we transfer food into energy, how we store and use energy in order to live. If we had no structure, if we had no energy, if we had no identity, we wouldn't be us. And in fact, no living being could exist without phosphorus. And because phosphorus is the rarest of the six most essential elements for life, some astronomers, some astrophysicists have used traces of phosphorus to try to search for life on other planets. If you can find a trace of phosphorus somewhere, that is at least a precondition for the creation of life, for the existence of life. However, there's really no evidence of it. We're very rare in the amount, the level of access that we have to phosphorus on Earth. And so if you think about the rarity of, say, phosphorus under the sea in a whale fall, in the body of a whale that has descended, the available phosphorus from that whale is rare in the ocean, and the available phosphorus on Earth is rare in our galaxy.
So understand that phosphorus comes from death, right? Phosphorus comes from what bones? What is it? So this is your statement, there would be no life without constant death. Where does phosphorus come from?
There are trace amounts of phosphorus located all over the world in bodies and rocks and as with many chemical elements, you could find little bits. If you were to dissect a mountain, you would find tiny pieces of, the atoms, not a piece of rock, but just phosphorus atoms all throughout. But the concentrations, the largest concentrations of phosphorus overwhelmingly are held by life, by trees, by humans, by other animals, by fungi and bacteria. And in the human body, the greatest concentrations of phosphorus, or we could say phosphate, are in our bones and in our teeth. Our teeth are made of the same material that is mined by phosphate miners. Our teeth are made of apatite, A-P-A-T-I-T-E. And this is the same rock, generally, that if you were to go to a phosphate mine, as I have been to, and see the phosphate being removed, that is also apatite. And this apatite forms our teeth. Our bones are made of phosphate. In order to grow, we need to eat phosphate. In order to make every single cell in our body, we need to have some amount of phosphate in our food, which comes from our land, which comes in some cases from fertilizers.
Well, let's take a break. Much more, obviously, to discuss here. We're talking with Jack Lohman. His new book is out and available. Very interesting read. It's called White Light, The Elemental Role of Phosphorus in Our Cells, in Our Food, and in Our World. We'll be back after this brief break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. I'm talking today with Jack Lohman. His new book, out and available now, is called White Light: The Elemental Role of Phosphorus in Ourselves, in Our Food, and in Our World. We've learned that phosphorus is the rarest of six elements biology needs for life to occur. It's one of the main ingredients found in fertilizer. Has a lot of geopolitical implications as well. We talked about Nauru, which was essentially a lush island which was strip mined over about a century and now is left desolate. That in turn enriched Australia and other nations. Jack Lohman, you've talked a little bit about this life cycle. Tell me a little bit more about that. You've established that phosphorus, it is found in small amounts in rocks and other things, but largest amounts in bones and teeth, right? So from death comes life.
That's right. When any organism dies, when any plant or animal or bacteria, fungus dies, we decompose. Our bodies lay on the ground. They release their nutrients back into the ground. Prime among those nutrients is phosphorus. That phosphorus works as a fertilizer. It feeds the plants that are living there. It feeds the trees, the grasses. Those grow. Animals consume them. Other animals consume them. Eventually, those animals die. Their bodies return to the ground. That's the cycle. Part of the cycle is waste as well. When we use manure to fertilize fields, we're taking our wastes. We're taking the wastes of animals, and we're returning those animal wastes to the ground as fertilizer. That's how the phosphorus cycle works in a local way. In a bigger, in a national or regional or even global way, we can look at how phosphorus is contained in trace amounts in mountains, in any kind of rock. The magma of the earth contains little, very, very spread out amounts of phosphorus. Certainly not enough that you could mine it or use it as a fertilizer, but enough that if mountains rise up and those mountains slowly erode and rivers wash over them and rush downstream, there are little bits of phosphorus contained in that water, and that phosphorus will run into the surrounding area. As a child, when you hear about ancient Egypt, the way that the ancient Egyptians harnessed the flooding powers of the Nile River in order to fertilize their lands. What they were doing was holding phosphorus in place, because the Ethiopian plateau, the mountains high up in the headwaters of part of the Nile River, contain somewhat high levels of phosphorus in trace amounts. The river rushes downward. When it floods, it carries with it all of this dark silt. And that dark silt is phosphorus. It contains phosphorus. And what the Egyptians did, for the most part, was build large dams to try to hold this water in place in various places on their farmland, so that as the water rushed, it didn't just flood and disappear, but it flooded and stayed. And because of the works that they built, it stayed for even longer. Months at a time, this phosphorus was slowly seeping into the soil. They were harnessing the power of the phosphorus cycle. If they hadn't captured that phosphorus, it would have continued rushing. It would have gone into the Mediterranean Sea. Rivers all around the world carry phosphorus into the ocean. The ocean circulates it for hundreds, thousands, sometimes millions of years. It settles on the ocean floor sometimes. Other times it wells up in areas, particularly off the coasts of Western Africa and Western South America. It feeds large amounts of life in those places. If it settles on the ocean floor, it stays there for millions of years. But as the plates of the earth move, as they slowly shift, it becomes pushed up, perhaps into mountains, and those mountains over time continue the cycle of phosphorus being rushed through the rivers and onto farmland and all else. It's a local, regional, and global cycle that is always, always happening.
So, of course, there's always been phosphorus and phosphate, but traces back to the 1840s in England, right? The idea that we could mine phosphate and then use that kind of an industrial scale for farming, for agriculture. And this gets us to a fascinating figure, John Stevens Henslow. Tell me about him.
John Stevens Henslow was a scientist who had many specialties, as Victorian scientists often did, but those specialties included botany and mineralogy. He was a professor at the University of Cambridge. He was the mentor to Charles Darwin. He was a figure of great local renown at the time. At some point in his career, he begins to become frustrated by his position at the university because the university was not wealthy, the University of Cambridge as a whole, and it did not in particular provide enough support to the sciences. This was primarily a religious university when it began, and until about 100-something years ago, there wasn't a lot of focus put on the sciences there. And so Henslow, rather than continue his professorship sometime after he is working with Darwin, he instead goes and takes the rectorship. He takes the position of the local leader, the religious, political, judicial leader of the small village of Hitcham in the county outside Cambridge. While he's there, he begins to see for himself the depredations of the countryside. He sees the way that the land has been destroyed, the failure of some local farming, the anger of local farm workers who have been put upon by the landed interests, by the wealthiest people who have been pushing them off their land, taking huge profits and leaving people in destitution. As a result, people in his parish in Hitcham and in many, many other parishes all across rural England are rioting. They're burning haystacks, burning the buildings of the wealthy farmers. They're participating in intense bouts of rage that are responding to what has been done to them as workers and as people. Henslow tries to do all kinds of things to fix this situation. He is generally more enlightened than many of the other leaders in the countryside. He is pushing scientific education. He's trying to teach people better ways of farming, trying to give access to small pieces of land for the poorest people. One thing that he does is take a walk along the coast of the sea near his village, and he begins to find these secretions of what he believes are dinosaur poops, coprolites. Turns out to be probably not, but instead different sorts of fossils. But what they are is phosphate rich. These are phosphate rocks. In 1842, he takes a walk. He sees these. He returns a year later. He sees them again. He begins writing papers because he's not only, of course, a local leader walking around, but he's also a scientist who recognizes rocks. He begins writing papers alerting people to this discovery because he believes that this phosphate rock that he's found could be processed into some kind of fertilizer that he thinks might help fix the social situation at the time. This is how the modern phosphate industry began.
You know, fascinating. And as this took off, this took some macabre turns, didn't it? I guess at a certain point we learned you can get phosphate from bones. And so companies or people went out looking for dead soldiers, etc.
You can get phosphorus from bones. And think about the implications of that. If you're a rampaging company that wants to turn a profit, you're going to be going to battlefields, as these companies did, picking up the bodies of dead soldiers. You're going to be going to ancient catacombs across the European continent, taking these bodies that might have been buried there for hundreds or thousands of years, which they did. You're going to be picking up cats, mummified cats they picked up in Egypt. The British Empire was conquering Egypt around this time. A merchant took 200,000 mummified cats, brought them back to the docks at Liverpool. They were ground up and turned into fertilizer. All kinds of strange and pretty icky sources of fertilizer were used. There were also some pretty good ones. People were pretty careful about using the parts of the animals that were available. There was a lot of slaughterhouse waste that went into making fertilizers. Words like tankage were thrown around. These were, the ground up, you could say the dried blood that was left over, the ground up bits that might not have been turned into any food, but were nevertheless rich in phosphorus, because again, the highest concentrations of phosphorus will come anywhere that there is life. Within that life, around that life, the role of life, biologically speaking, over time is to concentrate phosphorus. Our geological role, our biggest effect on the geology from day one, has been that we bring all of this phosphorus that's been dispersed across the world. We concentrate it into pockets that can then support future life. And so these companies, in primarily in England at the beginning, and across England and the British Empire, were collecting all of these different sources, sometimes from around their empire, including from the New World early on. And they were turning these into fertilizers in order to feed their fields and grow more food to feed the growing cities of the country.
Now, eventually, as this industry, the phosphate industry, takes off. Fascinating to me, the United States has a big role. Central Florida became the locus, I guess, of this industry, leader in this. Why did that happen?
And it still is
Oh, it still is.
it's at the very end of its dominance, and it's looking at continuing to mine phosphorus until somewhere in the middle of this century. But Central Florida is still the dominant player, particularly for the United States, but globally as well, in the phosphate industry. In the late 1800s, phosphorus fertilizer had come to the United States. People were using this phosphate that had been mined and manufactured in England and other places. They began to look for sources of it here because it was necessary. It's expensive to bring it in. People began to find ample quantities of phosphate rock in central Florida, in an area known as Bone Valley, because it has so many bones. So many fossilized specimens there along the Peace River between Tampa and Orlando in central Florida. This was mined at first. The river was mined because the river had pulled down, as just as the rivers pull trace amounts of phosphorus other places, they had pulled down actual phosphate pebbles in central Florida. And the mining companies came, and down about 100 something miles of river, they began scooping out these phosphate pebbles and turning them into fertilizer. They found over time that they could mine where these pebbles had come from on the land around the river. This became an enormous industry that even today churns through thousands of acres every year. Enormous machines strip the land. They dig down just as they had dug in Nauru, although there aren't towering coral pinnacles in Florida. The structure of the ground is different, but they dig down 50, 60 feet, remove the phosphorus, treat it, and ship it around the world. It's been a vitally important producer and exporter of mined phosphate fertilizers for over 100 years.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with the final segment with Jack Lohman. His new book is out and available. Very interesting book. You can find out much, much more than this conversation about phosphorus. It's called White Light: The Elemental Role of Phosphorus in Our Cells, in Our Food, and in Our World. We'll have more following this brief break. Thank you for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are talking with author Jack Lohman. You can find him at jacklohmanauthor.com. We're talking about his new book. It's called White Light: The Elemental Role of Phosphorus in Our Cells, in Our Food, and in Our World. It's out and available now. I want to talk about the geopolitics. Get back to that. You found a connection, Jack Lohman, between this naturalist, John Stevens Henslow, and Australia and Nauru. Interesting. John Stevens Henslow, not only the local vicar, not only a naturalist, but a magistrate. And apparently he, in that role, sent wrongdoers, convicts, to Australia. I learned a bit about that. I guess I had thought conditions were a little bit better for, you know, you got sent, you know, thousands of miles away, but then you were set loose upon the Australian landscape. I guess that came later. Tell me first about those conditions for those convicts sent to Australia.
Well, Australia was settled by the British in 1788. They wanted to send various convicts, and we say convict, and it sounds like somebody did something quite wrong, but it was usually just poor people who were being punished for being poor, were sent to Australia far away, intended to be a symbol of pain, a symbol of punishment. They could have stayed in England, but the government wanted people to know that they, if they committed some crime, if they committed a crime against the landowning classes of the country, that they might be punished in this quite terrible way, to be sent far away, living in conditions that they were not prepared for. They might have known how to farm the land in England. They probably knew very well. They had been pushed off that land by wealthy landed interests who wanted to make a profit rather than produce food. They wanted to, for example, raise sheep for wool to sell to the textile mills rather than allow local people to grow food to feed their communities. Those people often rebelled. Many of them were sent to Australia. Henslow sent some of them to Australia for stealing sheep from, in fact, one of these big farms that had been created. And when they reached Australia, they did not know how to farm the land. It was different land. You can't just go somewhere new and know what the conditions are. One of the conditions of the land in Australia is that it's traditionally been very low in phosphorus. The reason for this is that the soil is very, very, very old, and over time, the phosphorus has been depleted from it. That said, it's possible to farm there because people farmed there for thousands of years. Aboriginal Australians were able to produce all of the food that they needed. They raised crops, they raised animals, they hunted, they burned portions of the landscape in order to concentrate the nutrients, including phosphorus, down below. When the colonizers arrived and began to carry out a continent-wide genocide against the Aboriginal people, they also were carrying out a kind of genocide against the land. The land was destroyed. Land that was fertile when they arrived became infertile within a matter of years. It was not protected. People struggled. The farmers struggled. They were also punished there. The people, the colonizers who were sent from England, were sent to even more distant islands. Norfolk Island is one that sticks out in the consciousness, where they were tortured to death. And the idea was, just as Australia was a symbol to people back home, Norfolk Island and these other islands were symbols to people in the colony. In the colony, then, people were destroying the land, struggling. The 1800s progressed, and at the beginning of the 1900s, an Englishman working for an Australian mining business discovers phosphate in Nauru, and this is how the mining of Nauru began. The phosphate was mined. It was primarily sent to Australia, but it was also sent to Japan, to the United Kingdom, to New Zealand, some to the United States. It fed the land. And the really creepy, dark thing about this is that when we talk about mining different places around the world, we're often talking about mining a material that we use to make, you know, it goes into a product, or maybe we burn it for energy. When we talk about mining phosphorus, this is a material that we're putting in our bodies, and it goes to make up our DNA. It becomes literally who we are. And so when the Australians mined Nauru, the phosphate that they returned made up their bodies. And it made up our bodies too. If you lived in these countries throughout the 20th century, chances are you had, maybe still have, little bits of Nauru's land in your body. We may have it, I may have it. It's impossible to say. But this rock that was mined was spread out all throughout the world. And it was this early relationship with Australia that caused it to begin.
There's another tragic connection with Australia and Nauru, right? You write in the book, Australia has had a, as many other nations have had, has had a history of wanting to restrict immigration, only white, quote unquote, people. Tell me how that came to be, have another connection to Nauru.
When Australia became an independent nation in 1901, on the very first day of its independence, it passed what were known, what they called the White Australia laws. The White Australia policy was a policy that said, well, Australia is going to stay white, which is an insane thing to say when you consider that Australia wasn't even white for, 99% of its existence. And these colonizers arrived, insisted it was going to be white, blocked other people from coming. And these policies weren't ended until late in the 20th century. Australia during this time was becoming rich agriculturally, nationally, off of the phosphate it was importing from Nauru. The majority of the phosphate that it imported came from this island, which at the time was not independent until 1968. Nauru was governed by first as a colony, then as a trustee nation. And Australia was becoming wealthier. And when a country becomes wealthy, it then begins to shut its doors and try to prevent people from coming in, which is what this country was doing. That feeds into this parasitic relationship between Australia and Nauru today. Parasitic may not be quite the right word, but what's happening is that Australia is pushing people, non-white people who want to come to Australia, who need to come because they've been politically persecuted at home, forcing them to live in Nauru. And Nauru is dependent on Australia today because its land has been stripped. It's land that was stripped in order to feed and grow Australia.
I just have 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to have you talk just briefly about, you can find out much more in the book. It's called White Light. We're talking with the author, Jack Lohman. You talk about how we in modern times have disrupted the phosphorus cycle, especially in our agriculture. But you talk to some folks who are trying to heal that, right? Try to get us back to participating within the phosphorus cycle. Tell me very briefly about that.
That's right, because when we talk about mining phosphate rock and using phosphate fertilizer, it's only one kind of fertilizer. And it's only done, it really only works economically because the governments of the world subsidize it. Billions of dollars are given by the United States, Chinese, Indian, many other governments every year in order to make the kind of big fertilizer and pesticide-based agriculture that we now, in some cases, rely on work. But the subtext to that, the details there include the fact that a lot of the food that's grown, a lot of what is grown through that system, isn't actually going for us to eat. It's going to make biofuels. It's going to make really cheap, very unnutritional feed for animals living in animal factories. And it's if you look at the actual food that's being produced, it works much better. It tends to work much better within a system of agriculture that relies on inputs such as manure and compost and other forms of waste. One of the takeaways that I would like people to have from this book is that this is a big global environmental problem that can be fixed by doing small things on an individual basis. It can be fixed at least in part that way. If you want to help heal the phosphorus cycle to become a part of the earth, to be connected to our wastes and our lives and our deaths, composting vegetable scraps is an easy way to begin. This is rich in phosphorus. You're returning the phosphorus to the soil when you do this. You don't need to buy a fertilizer. if you have compost. If you take what you have, return it to the soil, you'll have not only enough phosphorus for your vegetables, for the flowers and plants that you grow, but you will have enough of all of these other nutrients, including organic carbon that you're returning to the soil and nitrogen and all of these phytonutrients and little bits and pieces of things that plants still need and that we need for our health. When we've begun to focus on these other kinds of artificial fertilizers, it's not good for us. It hurts our bodies. There's a long, long tradition of us growing and shaping the earth without needing to rely on these kinds of systems. And I hope that if you read this book, that's something that you take away, that there are wonderful things that we can do in order to reconnect with the earth.
Well, great place to end the conversation. Much else in the book. A fascinating book. It's out now. White Light, The Elemental Role of Phosphorus in Our Cells, in Our Food, and in Our World. We've been talking with the author, Jack Lohman. Jack Lohman, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.